Side 10.
"Well, what does it mean?" asked Mr. Scogan a little impatiently.
"Carminative," said Dennis, lingering lovingly over the syllables. "Carminative. I imagined vaguely that it had something to do with Carmen Carminus, still more vaguely with Caro Carnis and its derivatives, like carnival and carnation. Carminative. There was the idea of singing and the idea of flesh rose-coloured and warm, with a suggestion of the jollities of Micarem and the masked holidays of Venice. Carminative. The warmth, the glow, the interior ripeness were all in the word. Instead of which..."
"Do come to the point, my dear Dennis," protested Mr. Scogan. "Do come to the point."
"Well, I wrote a poem the other day," said Dennis. "I wrote a poem about the effects of love."
"Others have done the same before you," said Mr. Scogan. "There is no need to be ashamed."
"I was putting forward the notion," Dennis went on, "that the effects of love were often similar to the effects of wine, that Eros would intoxicate as well as Bacchus. Love, for example, is essentially carminative. It gives one the sense of warmth, the glow. And passion, carminative as wine, was what I wrote. Not only was the line elegantly sonorous, it was also, I flattered myself, very aptly and compendiously expressive. Everything was in the word carminative, a detailed exact foreground, an immense indefinite hinterland of suggestion. And passion, carminative as wine. I was not ill-pleased, and then suddenly it occurred to me that I'd never actually looked up the word in a dictionary. Carminative had grown up with me from the days of the cinnamon bottle. It had always been taken for granted. Carminative, for me, the word was as rich in content as some tremendous, elaborate work of art. It was a complete landscape with figures. And passion, carminative as wine. It was the first time I had ever committed the word to writing, and all at once I felt I would like lexicographical authority for it. A small English-German dictionary was all I had at hand. I turned up C-ca-car-com. There it was. Carminative. Windtreibend. Windtreibend, he repeated. Mr. Scogan laughed. Dennis shook his head.
"Ah," he said. "For me it was no laughing matter. For me it marked the end of a chapter, the death of something young and precious. There were the years, years of childhood and innocence, when I had believed that carminative meant, well, carminative. And now before me lies the rest of my life, a day, perhaps 10 years, half a century, when I shall know that carminative means windtreibend. Plus ne suis ce que j'ai été, et ne le saurai jamais être."
It is a realization that makes one rather melancholy.
"Carminative," said Mr. Scogan thoughtfully.
"Carminative," Dennis repeated, and they were silent for a time. "Words," said Dennis at last.
"Words. I wonder if you can realize how much I love them. You are too much preoccupied with mere things and ideas and people to understand the full beauty of words. Your mind is not a literary mind. The spectacle of Mr. Gladstone finding 34 rhymes to the name Margot seems to you rather pathetic than anything else. Mallarmé envelopes with their versified addresses leave you cold, unless they leave you pitiful. You can't see that. Apte à ne point de cabrer eu, poste et j'attouterai dia. Si tu ne fuis onze birour, Balzac chez cette heredia is a little miracle."
"You're right," said Mr. Scogan. "I can't."
"You don't feel it to be magical?"
"No."
"That's the test for the literary mind," said Dennis. "The feeling of magic, the sense that words have power. The technical, verbal part of literature is simply a development of magic. Words are man's first and most grandiose invention. With language, he created a whole new universe. What wonder if he loved words and attributed power to them? With fitted, harmonious words, the magicians summoned rabbits out of empty hats and spirits from the elements. Their descendants, the literary men, still go on with the process, mortising their verbal formulas together, and before the power of the finished spell, trembling with delight and awe. Rabbits out of empty hats? No, their spells are more subtly powerful, for they evoke emotions out of empty minds.
formulated by their art, the most insipid statements become enormously significant. For example, I proffer the constatation, black ladders lack bladders. A self-evident truth, one on which it would have not have been worthwhile to insist, had I chosen to formulate it in such words as, black fire escapes have no bladders, or les échelles noires manquent de vessie. But since I put it as I do, black ladders lack bladders, it becomes, for all its self-evidence, significant, unforgettable, moving. The creation by word power of something out of nothing, what is that but magic? And, I may add, what is that but literature? Half the world's greatest poetry is simply Les Échelles Noires Manquent de Vessie, translated into magic significance as black ladders lack bladders. And you can't appreciate words. I'm sorry for you. A mental carminative, said Mr. Scogan reflectively. That's what you need. Chapter 21. Perched on its four stone mushrooms, the little granary stood 2 or 3 feet above the grass of the green close. Beneath it, there was a perpetual shade and a damp growth of long, luxuriant grasses. Here, in the shadow, in the green dampness, a family of white ducks had sought shelter from the afternoon sun. Some stood, preening themselves, some reposed with their long bellies pressed to the ground, as though the cool grass were water. Little social noises burst fitfully forth, and from time to time some pointed tail would execute a brilliant Lycian tremolo. Suddenly, their jovial repose was shattered. A prodigious thump shook the wooden flooring above their heads. The whole granary trembled. Little fragments of dirt and crumbled wood rained down among them. With a loud, continuous quacking, the ducks rushed out from beneath this nameless menace, and did not stay their flight till they were safely in the farmyard. "Don't lose your temper," Anne was saying. "Listen, you frighten the ducks. Poor dears, no wonder." She was sitting sideways in a low wooden chair. Her right elbow rested on the back of the chair, and she supported her cheek on her hand. Her long, slender body drooped into curves of a lazy grace. She was smiling, and she looked at Gombauld through half-closed eyes.
"Damn you," Gombauld repeated, and stamped his foot again. He glared at her round the half-finished portrait on the easel.
"Poor ducks," Anne repeated. The sound of their quacking was faint in the distance. It was inaudible.
"Can't you see you make me lose my time?" he asked. "I can't work with you dangling about distractingly like this."
"You'd lose less time if you stopped talking and stamping your feet and did a little painting for a change. After all, what am I dangling about for except to be painted?"
Gombauld made a noise like a growl. "You're awful," he said with conviction. "Why do you ask me to come and stay here? Why do you tell me you'd like me to paint your portrait?"
"For the simple reasons that I like you, at least when you're in a good temper, and that I think you're a good painter."
"For the simple reason," Gombauld mimicked her voice, "that you want me to make love to you, and when I do, to have the amusement of running away."
Anne threw back her head and laughed. "So you think it amuses me to have to evade your advances? So like a man! If only you knew how gross and awful and boring men are when they try to make love and you don't want them to make love. If you could only see yourselves through our eyes!"
Gombauld picked up his palette and brushes and attacked his canvas with the ardour of irritation. "I suppose you were saying next you didn't start the game, that it was I who made the first advances, and you were the innocent victim who sat still and never did anything that could invite or allure me on."
"So like a man again," said Anne. "It's always the same old story about the woman tempting the man. The woman lures, fascinates, invites, and man, noble man, innocent man, falls a victim. My poor Gombauld, surely you're not going to sing that old song again. It's so unintelligent, and I always thought you were a man of sense."
"Thanks," said Gombauld.
"Be a little objective," Anne went on. "Can't you see that you're simply externalizing your own emotions? That's what you men are always doing. It's so barbarously naive. You feel one of your loose desires for some woman, and because you desire her strongly, you immediately accuse her of luring you on, of deliberately provoking and inviting the desire. You have the mentality of savages. You might just as well say that a plate of strawberries and cream deliberately lures you on to feel greedy. In 99 cases out of 100, women are as passive and innocent as the strawberries and cream.
Well, all I can say is that this must be the 100th case, said Gombauld without looking up.
Anne shrugged her shoulders and gave vent to a sigh. I'm at a loss to know whether you're more silly or more rude.
After painting for a little time in silence, Gombauld began to speak again.
And then there's Dennis, he said, renewing the conversation as though it had only just been broken off. You're playing the same game with him. Why can't you leave that wretched young man in peace?
Anne flushed with a sudden and uncontrollable anger. It's perfectly untrue about Dennis, she said indignantly. I never dreamt of playing what you beautifully call the same game with him. Recovering her calm, she added in her ordinary cooing voice and with her exacerbating smile, You've become very protective towards poor Dennis all of a sudden.
I have, Gombauld replied with a gravity that was somehow a little too solemn. I don't like to see a young man...
Being whirled along the road to ruin, said Anne, continuing his sentence for him. I admire your sentiments, and believe me, I share them.
She was curiously irritated at what Gombauld had said about Dennis. It happened to be so completely untrue. Gombauld might have some slight ground for his reproaches, but Dennis, no, she had never flirted with Dennis. Poor boy, he was very sweet. She became somewhat pensive. Gombauld painted on with fury. The restlessness of an unsatisfied desire, which before had distracted his mind, making work impossible, seemed now to have converted itself into a kind of feverish energy. When it was finished, he told himself the portrait would be diabolic. He was painting her in the pose she had naturally adopted at the first sitting, seated sideways, her elbow on the back of the chair, her head and shoulders turned at an angle from the rest of her body towards the front. She had fallen into an attitude of indolent abandonment. He had emphasized the lazy curves of her body, the lines sagged as they crossed the canvas, the grace of the painted figure seemed to be melting into a kind of soft decay. The hand that lay along the knee was as limp as a glove. He was at work on the face now. It had begun to emerge on the canvas, dull-like in its regularity and listlessness. It was Anne's face, but her face as it would be, utterly unillumined by the inward lights of thought and emotion. It was the lazy, expressionless mask which was sometimes her face. The portrait was terribly like, and at the same time, it was the most malicious of lies. Yes, it would be diabolic when it was finished, Gombauld decided. He wondered what she would think of it. Chapter 22. For the sake of peace and quiet, Dennis had retired earlier on the same afternoon to his bedroom. He wanted to work, but the hour was a drowsy one, and lunch, so recently eaten, weighed heavily on body and mind. The meridian demon was upon him. He was possessed by that bored and hopeless postprandial melancholy which the Cernobites of old knew and feared under the name of acidy. He felt, like Ernest Dowson, a little weary. He was in the mood to write something rather exquisite and gentle and quietist in tone, something a little droopy, and at the same time, how should he put it? A little infinite. He thought of Anne, of love, hopeless and unattainable. Perhaps that was the ideal kind of love, the hopeless kind, the quiet, theoretical kind of love. In this sad mood of repletion, he could well believe it. He began to write. One elegant quatrain had flowed from beneath his pen. A brooding love, which is at most the stealth of moonbeams when they slide, evoking colour's bloodless ghost, or some scarce breathing breast or side. When his attention was attracted by a sound from outside, he looked down from his window. There they were, Anne and Gombauld, talking, laughing together. They crossed the courtyard in front and passed out of sight through the gate in the right-hand wall. That was the way to the green close and the granary. She was going to sit for him again. His pleasantly depressing melancholy was dissipated by a puff of violent emotion. Angrily he threw his quatrain into the waste-paper basket and ran downstairs. The stealth of moonbeams, indeed. In the hall he saw Mr. Scogan. The man seemed to be lying in wait.
Dennis tried to escape, but in vain. Mr. Scogan's eye glittered like the eye of the ancient mariner.
"Not so fast," he said, stretching out a small saurian hand with pointed nails. "Not so fast. I was just going down to the flower garden to take the sun. We'll go together."
Dennis abandoned himself. Mr. Scogan put on his hat, and they went out arm in arm. On the shaven turf of the terrace, Henry Wimbush and Mary were playing a solemn game of bowls. They descended by the yew tree walk. It was here, thought Dennis, here, that Anne had fallen, here that he had kissed her, here, and he blushed with retrospective shame at the memory, here that he had tried to carry her and failed. Life was awful.
"Sanity," said Mr. Scogan, suddenly breaking a long silence. "Sanity. That's what's wrong with me, and that's what will be wrong with you, my dear Dennis, when you're old enough to be sane or insane. In a sane world, I should be a great man. As things are in this curious establishment, I am nothing at all, to all intents and purposes. I don't exist. I am just vox et praeterae nihil."
Dennis made no response. He was thinking of other things. "After all," he said to himself, "after all, Gombauld is better looking than I, more entertaining, more confident, and besides, he's already somebody. I'm still only potential."
"Everything that ever gets done in this world is done by madmen," Mr. Scogan went on.
Dennis tried not to listen, but the tireless insistence of Mr. Scogan's discourse gradually compelled his attention.
"Men such as I am, such as you may possibly become, have never achieved anything. We're too sane, we're merely reasonable. We lack the human touch, the compelling, enthusiastic mania. People are quite ready to listen to the philosophers for a little amusement, just as they would listen to a fiddler or a mountebank. But as to acting on the advice of the men of reason, never. Wherever the choice has had to be made between the man of reason and the madman, the world has unhesitatingly followed the madman, for the madman appeals to what is fundamental, to passion and the instincts, the philosophers to what is superficial and supererogatory, reason."
They entered the garden. At the head of one of the alleys stood a green wooden bench, embayed in the midst of a fragrant continent of lavender bushes. It was here, though the place was shadeless and one breathed hot, dry perfume instead of air, it was here that Mr. Scogan elected to sit. He thrived on untempered sunlight.
"Consider, for example, the case of Luther and Erasmus."
He took out his pipe and began to fill it as he talked.
"There was Erasmus, a man of reason if ever there was one. People listened to him at first, a new virtuoso, performing on that elegant and resourceful instrument, the intellect. They even admired and venerated him. But did he move them to behave as he wanted them to behave? Reasonably, decently, or at least a little less porkishly than usual? He did not. And then Luther appears, violent, passionate, a madman insanely convinced about matters in which there can be no conviction. He shouted, and men rushed to follow him. Erasmus was no longer listened to. He was reviled for his reasonableness. Luther was serious. Luther was reality, like the Great War. Erasmus was only reason and decency. He lacked the power, being a sage, to move men to action. Europe followed Luther and embarked on a century and a half of war and bloody persecution. It's a melancholy story."
Mr. Scogan lighted a match. In the intense light, the flame was all but invisible. The smell of burning tobacco began to mingle with the sweetly acrid smell of the lavender.
"If you want to get men to act reasonably, you must set about persuading them in a maniacal manner. The very sane precepts of the founders of religions are only made infectious by means of enthusiasms which to a sane man must appear deplorable. It is humiliating to find how impotent unadulterated sanity is. Sanity, for example, informs us that the only way in which we can preserve civilization is by behaving decently and intelligently. Sanity appeals and argues. Our rulers persevere in their customary porkishness, while we acquiesce and obey. The only hope is a maniacal crusade. I am ready when it comes to beat a tambourine with the loudest, but at the same time I shall feel a little ashamed of myself. However..."
Mr. Scogan shrugged his shoulders, and, pipe in hand, made a gesture of resignation.
It's futile to complain that things are as they are. The fact remains that sanity unassisted is useless. What we want, then, is a sane and reasonable exploitation of the forces of insanity. We sane men will have the power yet.
Mr. Scogan's eyes shone with a little more than ordinary brightness, and, taking his pipe out of his mouth, he gave vent to his loud, dry, and somehow rather fiendish laugh.
"But I don't want power," said Dennis. He was sitting in limp discomfort at one end of the bench, shading his eyes from the intolerable light. Mr. Scogan, bolt upright at the other end, laughed again. "Everybody wants power!" he said. "Power in some form or other. The sort of power you hanker for is literary power. Some people want power to persecute other human beings. You expend your lust for power in persecuting words, twisting them, melding them, torturing them to obey you. But I divagate."
"Do you?" asked Dennis faintly.
"Yes," Mr. Scogan continued unheeding. "The time will come. We men of intelligence will learn to harness the insanities to the service of reason. We can't leave the world any longer to the direction of chance. We can't allow dangerous maniacs like Luther, mad about dogma, like Napoleon, mad about himself, to go on casually appearing and turning everything upside down. In the past it didn't so much matter, but our modern machine is too delicate. A few more knocks like the Great War, another Luther or two, and the whole concern will go to pieces in future. The men of reason must see that the madness of the world's maniacs is canalized into proper channels, is made to do useful work, like a mountain torrent driving a dynamo."
"Making electricity to light a Swiss hotel," said Dennis. "You ought to complete the simile."
Mr. Scogan waved away the interruption. "There's only one thing to be done," he said. "The men of intelligence must combine, must conspire, and seize power from the imbeciles and maniacs who now direct us. They must found the rational state."
The heat that was slowly paralyzing all Dennis's mental and bodily faculties seemed to bring to Mr. Scogan additional vitality. He talked with an ever-increasing energy. His hands moved in sharp, quick, precise gestures. His eyes shone. Hard, dry, and continuous, his voice went on sounding and sounding in Dennis's ears with the insistence of a mechanical noise.
"In the rational state," he heard Mr. Scogan saying, "human beings will be separated into distinct species, not according to the colour of their eyes or the shape of their skulls, but according to the qualities of their mind and temperament. Examining psychologists, trained to what would now seem an almost superhuman clairvoyance, will test each child that is born and assign it to its proper species. Duly labelled and docketed, the child will be given the education suitable to members of its species and will be set in adult life to perform those functions which human beings of his variety are capable of performing."
"How many species will there be?" asked Dennis.
"A great many, no doubt," Mr. Scogan answered. "The classification will be subtle and elaborate, but it is not in the power of a prophet to go into details, nor is it his business. I will do no more than indicate the three main species into which the subjects of the rational state will be divided."
He paused, cleared his throat, and coughed once or twice, evoking in Dennis's mind the vision of a table with a glass and water bottle, and lying across one corner, a long white pointer for the lantern pictures.
"The three main species," Mr. Scogan went on, "will be these: the directing intelligences, the men of faith, and the herd. Among the intelligences will be found all those capable of thought, those who knew how to attain to a certain degree of freedom, and alas, how limited, even among the most intelligent, that freedom is, from the mental bondage of their time. A select body of intelligences, drawn from among those who have turned their attention to the problems of practical life, will be the governors of the rational state. They will employ as their instruments of power the second great species of humanity, the men of faith, the madmen, as I have been calling them, who believe in things unreasonably, with passion, and are ready to die for their beliefs and their desires. These wild men, with their fearful potentialities for good or for mischief, will no longer be allowed to react casually to a casual environment. There will be no more Caesar Borgias, no more Luthers and Mohammeds, no more Joanna Southcotes, no more Comstocks. The old-fashioned man of faith and desire, that haphazard creature of brute circumstance who might drive men to tears and repentance, or who might equally well set them on to cutting one another's throats, will be replaced by a new sort of madman, still externally the same, still babbling with a seemingly spontaneous enthusiasm, but ah, how very different from the madman of the past. For the new man of faith will be expending his passion, his desire, and his enthusiasm in the propagation of some reasonable idea. He will be, all unawares, the tool of some superior intelligence.
Mr. Scogan chuckled maliciously. It was as though he were taking a revenge, in the name of reason, on the enthusiasts.
From their earliest years, as soon, that is, as the examining psychologists have assigned them their place in the classified scheme, the men of faith will have had their special education under the eye of the intelligences. Melded by a long process of suggestion, they will go out into the world preaching and practicing with a generous mania the coldly reasonable projects of the directors from above. When these projects are accomplished, or when the ideas that were useful a decade ago have ceased to be useful, the intelligences will inspire a new generation of madmen with a new eternal truth. The principal function of the men of faith will be to move and direct the multitude, that third great species consisting of those countless millions who lack intelligence and are without valuable enthusiasm. When any particular effort is required of the herd, when it is thought necessary for the sake of solidarity that humanity shall be kindled and united by some single enthusiastic desire or idea, the men of faith, primed with some simple and satisfying creed, will be sent out on a mission of evangelization. At ordinary times, when the high spiritual temperature of a crusade would be unhealthy, the men of faith will be quietly and earnestly busy with the great work of education. In the upbringing of the herd, humanity's almost boundless suggestibility will be scientifically exploited. Systematically, from earliest infancy, its members will be assured that there is no happiness to be found except in work and obedience. They will be made to believe that they are happy, that they are tremendously important beings, and that everything they do is noble and significant. For the lower species, the earth will be restored to the center of the universe, and man to preeminence on the earth. Oh, I envy the lot of commonalty in the rational state, working their 8 hours a day, obeying their betters, convinced of their own grandeur and significance and immortality. They will be marvelously happy, happier than any race of men has ever been. They will go through life in a rosy state of intoxication from which they will never awake. The men of faith will play the cupbearers of this lifelong bacchanal, filling and ever filling again with the warm liqueur that the intelligences, in sad and sober privacy behind the scenes, will brew for the intoxication of their subject.
And what will be my place in the rational state? Dennis drowsily inquired from under his shading hand. Mr. Scogan looked at him for a moment in silence.
"It's difficult to see where you would fit in," he said at last. "You couldn't do manual work. You're too independent and unsuggestible to belong to the larger herd. You have none of the characteristics required in a man of faith. As for the directing intelligences, they will have to be marvelously clear and merciless and penetrating."
He paused and shook his head.
"No, I can see no place for you, only the lethal chamber."
Deeply hurt, Dennis emitted the imitation of a loud Homeric laugh.
"I'm getting sunstroke here," he said, and got up.
Mr. Scogan followed his example, and they walked slowly away down the narrow path, brushing the blue lavender flowers in their passage. Dennis pulled a sprig of lavender and sniffed at it. Then some dark leaves of rosemary that smelt like incense in a cavernous church. They passed a bed of opium poppies, dispetaled now. The round, ripe seed heads were brown and dry, like Polynesian trophies, Dennis thought. Severed heads stuck on poles. He liked the fancy enough to impart it to Mr. Scogan.
"Like Polynesian trophies?"
Uttered aloud, the fancy seemed less charming and significant than it did when it first occurred to him. There was a silence, and in a growing wave of sound, the whir of the reaping machine swelled up from the fields beyond the garden, and then receded into a remoter hum.
"It is satisfactory to think," said Mr. Scogan as they strolled slowly onward, "that a multitude of people are toiling in the harvest fields in order that we may talk of Polynesia. Like every other good thing in this world, leisure and culture have to be paid for. Fortunately, however, it is not the leisured and the cultured who have to pay. Let us be duly thankful for that, my dear Dennis. Duly thankful," he repeated, and knocked the ashes out of his pipe. Dennis was not listening. He had suddenly remembered Anne. She was with Gombauld, alone with him in his studio. It was an intolerable thought.
"Shall we go and pay a call on Gombauld?" he suggested carelessly. "It would be amusing to see what he's doing now."
He laughed inwardly to think how furious Gombauld would be when he saw them arriving.
End of side 10.